Talo Falava, I'm Sosef Womoli. Join me for Sister Sounds, a music show dedicated to showcasing the breadth of talented female musicians and performers from across the Pacific. Sister Sounds will bring you amazing local talent mixed with the sounds and vibe our Islander audiences love by artists from across the seas as well. Search up ABC Sister Sounds to listen online or find it in the ABC Listen app.
This is an ABC podcast.
This is Stories from the Pacific on ABC Radio Australia.
Hello, and welcome to Stories from the Pacific on ABC Radio Australia. I'm Wendy Mockey. Our next guest on Stories from the Pacific is a total firecracker. It's none other than Mr. Jay Waimara, a proud Gudang, Yadai Kenu, and Saibai Kalau man in the Torres Strait. Jay's a hilarious comedian, fierce drag performer, and self-confessed black nerd. Born in Townsville and raised across Canberra, Fiji, and Wollongong, Jay's comedy blends sharp wit with deep love for community. From open mics in Cairns to the stages of Edinburgh Fringe, he uses laughter as both survival and celebration. Whether he's serving up Rihanna Matrix, his drag alter ego, or taking aim at racism and homophobia, Jay is flipping the script one punchline at a time. Jay, welcome to Stories from the Pacific. How are you, my brother?
I'm good, sis. Oh, wow. It's such a pleasure to be here. Oh, my goodness. Finally, some ABC radio exposure.
Listen, we're so glad that you said yes and that you're here and also being blessed black and highly favored. So thank you for your presence.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here. And as soon as I heard you were on, sis, I thought, oh, why not? It's not so often you get to speak to a NIDA graduate.
Okay. Now let's take it back. Let's take it back to your early life. Let's start with your roots. Tell us where you were born.
The story starts many years ago in the wild, wild places of 1991, on a night in Townsville in North Queensland. In 1991, there was a pretty significant drought. And so this is around November. And the day I was born, my mum was 19 years old. My father was 22, I believe, fresh out of the Navy. And the very second I was born at Kerwin Women's General in Townsville, the drought broke. It broke the drought. And that was the first time I ever made an entrance. So it was.
Oh, you are a miracle, is what you are.
So I don't tell people this often, but my birth name is Jordan. So that's why my parents named me that, because it was the river of life, the waters running down. Black people, we spiritual. So it's.
You really are.
Yes. And I've been raining on people ever since.
A beautiful story. So your parents had you when they were quite young, huh?
Very young, very young. Now, mum was 19 years old, like I said, and just absolutely wanted children, but also knew the challenges as well. Because 19, and she was in the middle of her law degree, actually, when she found out she was pregnant with me. So mama had to put that career on hold, which is why I'm always thankful to my mum very much. So mum and dad end up splitting up. And not long after that, mum moves to Canberra with me at 2 or 3 years old, something like that. And mum gets a job with the then incoming John Howard government. She's working with Foreign Affairs as one of the third secretaries under Alexander Downer. And so I immediately go from Townsville straight to diplomat brat, like that.
Well, how long were you in Canberra for?
A couple of years, about 2 or 3, I think. And after that comes the birth of my younger brother, Fletcher, who grows up to be a brilliant musician. And then not long after that, I think around 1997 or 1998, we move to Fiji on behalf of the Australian government, where mum gets a job as the Australian ambassador in the Fijian government, representing our government's interest in Fiji at the time.
What was it like growing up in Fiji?
Canberra, very, very fun, but very structured as well. Like, everyone has to stand on ceremony. It's a bit stuffy. But Fiji's hotter, it's wilder, it's different. I mean, I learned what mosquitoes were for the first time at 9 years old. You go from PSAs about getting your flu shots to like full on spending classes about breaking down the symptoms of dengue. Meanwhile, you're there in your little school uniform with your salu and like, you know, your shirt's all pressed and you're just sitting still and like, yes, of course. Yeah, so you smell, you suddenly smell like coconut oil every day.
Wow, what a mix up though.
Yeah, and then, but then of course, if for those of us who know our history, in the year 2000, the civil unrest kicks in under the outgoing Mahendra Chaudhry government, and the Spate coup kicks in with the Fijian Liberation Nationalist Party, I think. So within the space of like 2 years, not even, the world you suddenly have gotten used to starts crumbling because the government's under attack and people are car bombing and there are protests and police everywhere and a lot of racially motivated civil unrest. And the story I normally tell people is, it's a normal day at school, we haven't heard anything, and then all of a sudden the international school where I went to, ISS in Fiji, in Suva, it's quite close to town. So all of a sudden, like during lunch break, we hear like these loud like bangs, just and the vague notion that you have of things that you have as a child immediately in the back of my mind, they go, oh, that sounds like gunshots. And we come back from lunch, we sit down in our classroom. I've got a very clear memory of this. My teacher, Mr. Mitchell, who is this beautiful Fijian man, just like really, really straight. He said, he gathers us all into class. And he says, all right, class, look, just go copy what's on the board that I've written down or read your books. I'm just going to go to the staff room for a minute. And, of course, filling in those blanks later, I realized he had to go have an emergency meeting with the entire school staff and the principal because they were trying to figure out what to do, because they'd obviously gotten the news that the Capitol was about to be seized and the government buildings were about to be stormed and all of this. So he comes back maybe 15, 20 minutes later. And he's sort of very quiet. He's quite stone-faced. And he rubs out everything on the board. We're all like, hey, hang on, what are you doing? We're trying to copy that down. And he rubs everything off the board, and he writes the word C-O-U-P, coup, on the board. And he says, children, everyone sit down, pay attention. Now, do you know what this word is? And I will forever thank my teacher for this. Now, I know it's coup like soup, but that's not what it means. It's pronounced coup. And he explained the whole thing to us. He didn't mince any words. He just said, so there are a series of people who disagree with the government and they're using violent or radical means to take over the government, and they're currently storming through the city. So you're not going to be safe here at school. What we need to do is we need to evacuate you all back to your homes. The buses are ready. You're going to have the rest of the day off. And that day turned into a couple of weeks, I'm pretty sure. Mum's working with the Australian Embassy portion of the Fijian government, and when I've asked Mum about this, she said, well, look, it wasn't easy. Like, I was literally risking my life every day to go to work.
That's right. Yeah.
And being as dark as, dark-skinned as Mum is, which is might come as a surprise to your audience, my mum would get like heavily security searched every day because they thought she was a spy, you know, for the resistance.
Oh my gosh. That's insane. That's actually crazy.
Mm. Yeah, so just, you know, knowing what we know about government takeovers now in our adult years, it's like, oh, okay. The only time that I got a proper look at what was happening at that age, at that time, was we had one chance, me and my brother and our housemaid, our caretaker, we had one opportunity to go out into town in a couple of weeks to go and get some groceries and resupply. And this is probably one example very early that informs my humor, because humor is very much about contrast, interestingly, because, you know, like, well, you know, what's the incongruency, what doesn't fit here, and it was this very thing. So we go to town, and the local supermarket, the big supermarket that we had, the markets are all flooding with, like, you know, soldiers and, you know, emergency services, paramedics, like everything's looking really rough. But the supermarket has been completely bombed out. Like, it's just a shell. There's nothing left. There's nothing left. I remember that. Yeah. But yeah, just like it's been torched. It's just, there's nothing there. And about two blocks up the road, there's a McDonald's, and it's perfectly fine.
Those arches.
Oh, they're like, there's all this craziness. I know, there's all this madness going on one side, and then all of a sudden, the golden arches just, ooh, like,
oh my God.
The Macca's was fine. Really?
So how long did you stay on for after the unrest?
The Australian government is just sort of systematically just like grabbing all of its nationals one at a time. So we're essentially on a waiting list to be evacuated. And by the way, this whole time while we're waiting, I'm watching the news at like 9 years old, trying to figure out what the hell is going on. And on the phone occasionally just thinking like, all right, well, you know, they're talking about sending the Australian military in. And I'm just like, and I'm thinking, okay, well, maybe Australian soldiers are going to come and pick us up. I don't know. So Fletcher's dad comes over and picks us up on our behalf and grabs us like a couple of weeks after that. Mum has to stay in Fiji, unfortunately. And so we miss Mum, and it's just like, oh, well, but this, we have to go. We need to get somewhere safe. And then it's the end of the year 2000, and we go from Fiji, smack bang, into Wollongong.
You're listening to Stories from the Pacific on ABC Radio Australia with my guest, comedian Jay Waimara. Jay, as we continue your story, you just left the civil unrest in Fiji and now you find yourself in Wollongong, a regional town in New South Wales. It has a steelworks, one soccer team and one basketball team, but it's predominantly a white community. And I heard this is where you've learned something very interesting.
This was the first time that I learned what racist jokes were. Like, and I look, 10 years old, I don't know what a racist joke is. I just know what certain racist words are. But I'm like, you know what? I think these are just jokes. And like, I'm not hurt by it. Like, you feel the hurt that you're at the expense of the joke, but not like the deep racism that comes from that. So I'm just hitting them back with stuff. And the thing is, that's when I realized at 10, because you start clicking on at that age, I start realizing that like it's really funny until you hit them back with something, until the sass comes out. So I had to learn how to defend myself with humor at that point. So, and everyone's hitting me with like, and it's like, yeah, all right, so like black joke, black joke, black joke. And I'm like, so if I stuck a flag in your back, would I own you?
So I'm assuming you were very popular and made a lot of friends.
I was the nerdy kid with an attitude. That was the thing. I found my crowd very early. I watched handball games. I learned how to double dutch, and I lived in the library at Big Lunch. That's all I did. I can't remember the head librarian, her name. I think she was about 40 or something, and she was Greek. Now this was also the first time I'd ever heard the word in my life as well. Now, honestly, I'd heard the word, but I didn't think much of it until someone told me what it meant. And then I was like, that's really mean. You don't need to say that.
And did you come across that particular word in Wollongong, like growing up, like yes, spending time there? Right. Okay. Mm-hmm.
I did. First of all, my stepfather was very keen on just squashing that immediately with the kid who called me that and said, don't ever call my son that. Don't do that at all. So I'm like, all right, cool. So that's very clearly wrong. You shouldn't say something like that. And like, you know, I was teased for other things, but it never really internalized it or bothered me. But it wasn't until I got to start spending time in the library that I hung out with my head librarian there. And she goes, look, how bad do you think that word is for you? And how much power are you giving that? That's the first time I'd ever learned the dialectics of racism. And so she goes, well, how bad do you think that word is for you? And do you think you're a b-? And I go, well, no, I just think I'm me. And she goes, that's exactly what you should be thinking. Because everyone calls me a b-, but I know how bad they think that is, but I don't give that any power.
Wow. Shout out to that Greek queen. I can imagine that as a young black kid, that was the start of a journey for you about the power of words and how you were able to flip it on its head. It also seems like that's where you start developing your sense of humor. However, you're set for another change. Your mother is working as a customs officer on Thursday Island in the Torres Strait. Can you tell me what happens there?
She says to my stepfather, Fletcher's father, like, all right, I'd like the boys back, please. you know, if they can live together and come up to Thursday Island. I go, and this is when my brother and I are forced to separate because Fletcher's dad is just like, nope, I'm keeping Fletch here in Wollongong. Jay can go. So a little bit of tragedy there, but and look, my only conception at that time was like, I need to be with my mum. This is too, like, Wollongong is fine, but I'd rather be with my mum. So what follows a really long separation after, what follows a really long separation, so Fletcher stays, I go, and at 11 going on 12, something like that, having been through Canberra, Suva, and Wollongong all in the space of 10 years, and then having to move to TI, to Wyben, and then being told that, and being told immediately, oh, this is actually where you're from, son. these are your people. This is you. Getting it, and the clearest memory I have, the first moment I stepped off the plane on Horn Island, where the airport is, and I love this memory. My great grandfather, my Arthur Dugu, this is on my mum's side, her grandfather, he got up really early and went to the airport and waited all day for my afternoon flight to come in because he insisted on meeting me properly himself. Like, he'd already met me as a baby, and was very proud, but he sat and he waited for me.
What a beautiful memory.
And it was, yeah, and I know, and I've got this clear memory of just stepping off the plane, and even though I'd only seen maybe one or two photos of him, I spotted him straight away, and he was looking right at me from across the gate, and there he is sitting down with the sensible little smile on his face. He didn't say much. He just gave me a hug, and he said, come with me, boy. You're with me. So there's already this sense of place and anchoring that comes in just right from the minute I arrive. But then there's the everyday life has to kick in after that. So we go and live with my Akra and Ata Dugu. They're both so pleased to see me, you know, and then now the cultural education begins. So I got to live in the house. So what I count as a blessing always is I got to be the only great grandchild, the first one to properly live with those old people before they both passed away. And I think something that I think I needed as well at that point in my life, as I reflect, because it's the moment you spending time with your grandparents, you know, hopefully whoever's listening to this, hopefully your grandparents are good people, and I assume they would be. But the thing is your grandparents have your grandparents, your great-grandparents, they have so much to actually give you, and all you've got to do is just go and sit with them and spend time with them. That's all you have to do. You know, make them a cup of tea, have a drink with them, talk to them, but they'll start slowly just letting that out for you, you know, and just they've got so much. You know, so our elders are important. They always have been. Black people, we've known this forever, but it's not, you know, hammering the point too hard to say that it's just, you've got to do this. You have to spend time with these people.
Absolutely. I mean, spending time with our elders is so important, and it's wonderful that you get to live with your grandparents for those 3 years until your mom got her own place. Now, at that point, you were faced with even more challenges. I mean, you're 13 and you get sent to boarding school in Mianjin, Brisbane. What impact does this have on you?
So I'm a fish out of water. And I think looking back, I think I realized what part of that was, a lot of that mental unrest was for me, because I'm about to turn 13. And by the time, you know, I've lived and schooled in about four different locations up to this point. So I think in some part, I was just sick of moving. Like, I was so depressed. I got really bad depression. To the point where unaliving became an option for me. That was the thing. I was getting really sick. Yeah, which is a bit of a heavy thing to start considering at, you know, all of 13 years old.
I think
to deal with the loss, to deal with the separation of a sibling, to deal with, you know, having to move to three different schools in 10 years, to suddenly being exposed to your culture, but not fitting in socially, to then suddenly having to go to boarding school, all within the space of 13 years. And thank God I discovered journaling. And again, like, I would just do, I fell into the, at boarding school, I fell into the routines that I would normally do whenever I felt really isolated. You know, and again, like, it's that similar thing where there's literally only two Aboriginal or Indigenous or First Nations kids in the classroom, and I'm one of them, and no one knows where the Torres Straits is.
Yeah.
So it's so weird.
It sounds like you were going through a really rough time. So your mother brings you to Thursday Island for school. You're still feeling isolated, but you're also throwing yourself into music and volunteering at a community radio station. Now, there is another activity you're throwing yourself into, and this one has made an appearance before. What was that?
Comedy really kicks in at this point because I was a theatre kid. That's what I was. So. And I really loved just being part of an activity that really just was something that was very tailored to me, or something that really suited me. So performing, expressing myself, because there was no other way. I wasn't getting it at home. I wasn't getting it in the school, in the schoolyard during lunch. So if I wasn't in the library, I was just teaching myself how to do impressions. At that time, Jim Carrey's Grinch was the biggest thing in cinemas. I'm just learning how to do, these impressions and performing for myself and maybe one or two of my friends. And then my drama teacher hits me with the flyer for, I think I'm in grade 9 at this point. And my drama teacher goes, all right, have you heard of Class Clowns? Which is the school age competition for the Melbourne International Comedy Festival. And I go, well, all right, what do I do? And she goes, well, it's how you do stand-up comedy. And the funny thing is, I didn't want to do it. I was like, stand-up comedy, it sounds too hard. And it was my cousin, Godfrey Barrow, who's the same age as me at the time. And he goes, Bala, just do it anyway. It's going to be fun. And I went, man, fun. You're funny. Just go make him. And I'm like, no, Bala, I don't want to make him. I don't want to make the thing. And he goes, Bala, just do it. Do it. You're funny. Do your Grinch impression. Just do anything. So signed up. Trip to Cairns to the old Civic Theatre. This is the first time that your boy touched a microphone and made people laugh. The light bulb was a friggin' like arena spotlight. All of a sudden, a full audience of like 200-300 people, whatever it was, I said something, they laughed. And it was the kind of laugh that started at the front row. It built it and then it erupted and then the acoustics, it bounces off the wall, comes and hits you in the chest. And that's when the moment hits you and you go, oh, I like that noise. I want to do that again. I was supposed to be on for 3 minutes. I did 15.
No.
Immediately disqualified from the competition. But then I got bitten by the bug. That was it. It's like,
that was it.
This is what I'm going to be. This is where I put all of this frustration, all of this energy. It's like discovering science. You're just like, I've got to test this and pull this in every different direction. I could, and just figure out how to make this work again. I was ravenous. I needed this.
Okay, so you just said something then, because I think this would be interesting to unpack. Mm. Is this notion of bombing, and because you know that's when you kind of started and you were throwing everything at the wall, being like, what's funny, what's not? How talk to us about like. You as going up, standing in front of a room filled with people, trying to make them laugh and bombing, how do you deal with it?
The going wisdom about bombing is it reminds you that you're not invincible. You're not the funniest person in the room sometimes. That's just how it is. And bombing really is, I best define it as you learn what works and why it doesn't work. That's really it. But also... that knife cuts more than two ways. Like, it hurts. It's because stand-up comedy and performing in general is so raw and so emotional. It actually comes from the depths of your soul, the things that you think are the most funniest, the things that are most precious to you internally and emotionally and psychologically. To then put that on a plate, serve it to a room, and then not want to eat it, that hurts. And it reminds you that you're not going to have a 100% success rate. So it's designed to humble you. That's the teaching moment, I guess.
And do you find, does it get easier whenever it happens?
It does. You learn how to bounce back a little bit, but then there are days where, like, you've done the worst and the audience doesn't know I'm bombing. You learn all these little tips and techniques, all these verbal sleights of hand where you can just sort of, like, sidestep the bomb, but it's still going to graze you regardless.
What is it about live comedy that keeps you coming back?
Oh, that's a tough question. It's a good question. There's the part of me that has to be fed with, you know, performing for an audience, right? just pushing myself out there. Like there's some messed up need you have in your own body to just go, all right, I have to do this. It's just, I won't be able to sleep properly unless I tell a joke today. So there's definitely that, what keeps me coming back. It is addictive, I will say. Once you start getting really good at it, it's really addictive. But the other thing that keeps coming back, and this is probably on a very personal note, but it's that 13, 14-year-old Jay who performed in Cairns still listens to the audience laugh. And I wait for that magical tidal wave again to hear everyone. Because I believe really personally, deep down, that how you laugh is only how you laugh. Like it's the little signature of your soul.
You're hearing from Jay Waimara here on Stories from the Pacific. Jay, you don't just do stand-up comedy. You also grace the stage with your fabulous drag alter ego, Reanimation. So with this in mind, can you talk about what it means to navigate Black masculinity and queerness in your life and work?
I was about to say this is the $64,000 question, but then I realized we Black people, this is the $64 question. it's a topic that I've only recently started exploring properly, and queerness in Black spaces is such a shaky topic. It's an invisible wall, but the wall is still there. So masculinity has always been defined as this very typical, structured, strict set of traits. You know, it just is. You can't divert from the criteria. You have to be this in order, you have to tick this box, and this box in order to be considered seriously as a masculine person. That's doubled down like most things in the Black world, I believe, because being queer, you're not considered a real man or a real woman, or you're trying to be something you're not. You're masquerading as something. You're inauthentic for some reason. And I'm here to just go, especially through my comedies, go, that's bullshit. You know, like, it's like, you can believe that if you really want to, but it's not true. It's not true. And I think it's because through colonization, through the high narrowing of the lens and being able to exist in such defined terms in a post-colonial world, especially when you add religion into the mix, you get this really, again, this really strict criteria of what you're supposed to be in order to not just be accepted by your gender, but also by broad mainstream white society in general. You know, the Black man is somehow both dangerous, but if you put him in a dress, he's cheapened. You know, all of a sudden he's safe. And I'm like, did they ask us how we perceive of this? You know, at no point do they ask Black women, Black queer people, you know, how do we view this? Like, can we get that same level of self-determinism that you all get? You know, like, just how is it that we have to exist within a specific criteria? So when I see Felicia Fox in a set of kinky boots with the traditional paint on and everything, I just, to me, that says, baby, I am all of this.
If you're wondering who Felicia Fox is, they're a well-known Kamilaroi and Dungardi storyteller and drag performer in Australia. Now, Jay, what does it mean for you to carry on your family's legacy in your work today?
If you were asking me this 10 years ago, it would have meant something slightly different, but it means a lot more now that I've had to bury a lot of them. So I can say this with a slightly different perspective now at 33. Now, before, when a lot of them were still alive, it was just like, all right, I'm just going to just do my best. I'm going to keep doing my best, and I'm just going to keep pushing this out there until I can. And now the priority has changed slightly, and it's become, okay, I need to not only do my best, I've actually got to present the best thing now and actually work a little harder and just hold up the bar that they set. That's really it. So the cultural responsibility has kicked in now. You're catching me right at the beginning of a change.
It's really, really powerful stuff. I mean, there's so much heart in the way that you make space, not just for yourself, but then for the next ones coming through. You've built something that is sharp, hilarious, and deeply necessary. Thank you for sharing with us and for reminding us that sometimes the best way to fight back is to laugh loudly, live fully, and leave the door wide open behind you. And Jay, let us say it for the folks in the back. You belong here and we know it. We'll be watching and we're cheering you on. Thank you.
Word.
You've been listening to Stories from the Pacific, presented by me, Wendy Mockey, and produced by Jaden Mailata. If you like this episode and want more, be sure to listen to other episodes in our program by searching up Stories from the Pacific on our website or wherever you get your podcasts. This story was produced on the lands of the Yuggera and Turrbal people.